Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with a former senior policy advisor to the Secretary of Energy who recently wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, Unsafe at Any Reactor. Robert Alvarez joins us to discuss the nuclear disaster in Japan and the growing risk from uncontained radioactive contamination. Then we'll go to Cairo to talk with Mohamed Bamye, who wrote a recent article at the Islamic intellectual site Mufti.org. Is the 2011 Libyan revolution an exception? Along with discussing Libya, we'll also talk about political events in Egypt. Then finally, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning former New York Times war correspondent Chris Hedges about the corporate capture of not just the media, but of American politics, culture, and the economy. He is a regular columnist at truthdig.com, where he recently published an article, The Collapse of Globalism. Joining me now is Robert Alvarez, who is a senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He directs the IPS's nuclear energy project. He served as a senior policy advisor to the Secretary of Energy and as a deputy assistant secretary of energy from 1993 to 1999. He's one of the nation's foremost experts on military and civilian nuclear energy, and you can find his recent work, including his op-ed for the Los Angeles Times, Unsafe at Any Reactor, at ips-dc.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Alvarez.
Thank you for having me on your show.
It does appear that the nuclear disaster in Japan continually, I wouldn't say it gets worse, but because there's been such a paucity of information, such confusion between the government and the TEPCO, the Tokyo Power Authority, and now the head of TEPCO is taking hospital leave. So we still don't know the full extent of the contamination, but what we do know is pretty shocking, isn't it?
Well, I think that the accident is of such a magnitude and of such complexity and danger that they're still not out of the woods. And they're struggling desperately to try to gain control over the situation.
So when we learn that a couple of the workers were contaminated by the waste water that apparently was sloshing around in Reactor 3, and that is fueled by MOX fuel, which has plutonium in it. And the indication is that the core is exposed there because the levels were so high. My question is, what is happening to all that seawater that is so highly radioactive? Where does it go?
Well, they were using seawater to provide coolant for the reactor in the pools. And so I think it was either from runoff or discharges from the reactor and the pools.
But is this water going directly into the ocean because of the extraordinary high content of radioactive iodine that's been detected in the ocean?
Well, it's probably water that's come in contact with the radioactive core in the fuel rods.
And so it's leaking from the plant into the ocean?
I think that as a possibility you cannot rule out.
So we don't really know whether this water that is being sprayed constantly on this incredibly hot core, we don't know where that runoff is going.
A big question. I think that we are operating on fragmentary information. We don't have a complete picture of what's going on. I think the emergency responders are also operating with not all that much information about what's ahead of them. I think the one thing you can say about what's going on there is that it's a surprise if it isn't a surprise.
Do you think this is in any way complicated by Japan's political culture, where the prime minister tends to be a kind of political hack that's put in there by the backroom power brokers in the Liberal Democratic Party? And he's been constantly caught by surprise. His poll numbers are embarrassingly low. And now you've got the head of the Tokyo Power sort of slipping off to hospital.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think I can speculate on that, but what I can say is that the Japanese nuclear industry and other nuclear industries have a reputation for operating in secrecy and isolation from the public, and they are usually late in providing bad news, and usually the bad news is usually burnished before it gets out.
In general, though, I've often asked, had Victor Galinsky on recently and other people that, like yourself who've had a long career in nuclear energy, both military and civilian, there is this sense that the nuclear power industry or the lobby, if you will, is kind of like Lazarus. It comes back after Three Mile Island, it comes back after Chernobyl, and it may come out back after this. What's your sense on it? Because I take it that nuclear power will continue unabated in China and India, But what's its fate and future in the United States, do you think,
Robert? Well, I think that the so-called renaissance that has been widely touted in the United States for the past several years is gone. I mean, I think that it's the prospects of building new reactors in the United States are becoming increasingly dim. And they were dim even before this terrible accident. And the main reason is that that private investment has refused to have anything to do with nuclear power for over 30 years. And they still won't touch it with a 10-foot pole because of the very significant financial risks associated with building and operating these plants. So the only way that nuclear power could have a renaissance in the United States is if they could have unfettered access to the U.S. Treasury. And we're now in a stage in our political history, I guess, where there are tremendous pressures to cut federal spending and not to open the doors wide open to a special interest like this.
But as it stands now, of course, the Japanese situation could take years to resolve. The Japanese authorities have said that the four reactors, 1, 2, 3, and 4, will be permanently shut down. They are now talking about putting some kind of a blanket over it, a bit like the sarcophagus, I imagine, at Chernobyl. Do you have any understanding about what they plan to do to entomb these reactors?
Well, I think that whatever they do is going to have to be revisited sometime in the near future, because if they don't remove the major concentrations of long-lived radioactivity from that site, it's bound to leach out into the ocean and to the land nearby where there are a lot of people.
Well, the thing that the discussion we had earlier, Robert Alvarez, about the highly radioactive seawater that's been poured over this exposed core, the figure that I heard was that there are hundreds of tons of this water. Now,
I think it's more in the order of several thousands of tons.
Several thousands of tons of water, and we don't know where that water's gone, right?
Well, I think that you can assume that a lot of water was used to try to cool the reactors and the fuel ponds. A great deal of that water is likely to have been contaminated and have either been directly discharged through pipelines or from runoff from the site into the ocean.
And what would be that's pretty bad in itself. Obviously, a better alternative would be to somehow catch it all and store it. And would that be your analysis?
Well, I think in fairness to what's going on there, I'm sure that had they thought they had to resort to this rather desperate, what I referred to in the past as a Hail Mary gesture, they might have had the contingencies to do that, but they don't. And so this is what, they're stuck with.
And what do you do with highly radioactive seawater? What would be the preferred?
Well, I mean, the only thing you can do is, if it's been poured into the ocean, is hope it is diluted and decays.
And if it's kept in ponds?
You can't just dump that stuff in the ocean. I think that whatever the wastewater they have generated, that they do have some sort of containment over, they're going to have to decontaminate that liquid and try to dispose of the radioactivity in some other place.
But it would, if it's kept in big pools, have the ability to evaporate, and that would that not bring radioactivity up into the atmosphere?
To a certain extent. I assume that the cooling ponds and things like that, there's been evaporation going on, and there may be even possibility of drainage. But still, I think that they're going to have to decontaminate that water, probably using ion exchange equipment and the like, to try to remove as much radioactivity from the water as possible before it could be dumped.
So I guess in a way, in a very sort of hideously ironic way, Robert Alvarez, that this accident and this part of the accident, which we're talking about, is how do they get rid of the waste, is a kind of broader metaphor for the nuclear power problem and the weapons problem in the first place, which is, what do you do about the waste?
Well, I mean, this is, something that's an extreme example of what might go wrong and what kind of environmental safety and health legacy you leave behind, because, I think that what we're looking at is something that's going to prove hazardous to a large number of people for a very long time, and that's just going to be another sort of another unthinkable of the nuclear age.
And what we're left with thinking about here is, from this interview, Robert Alvarez, is that there are thousands of tons of highly contaminated water that nobody knows where it is and nobody knows what to do with it.
Well, I also, you have to consider that there's also hundreds of tons of highly irradiated spent fuel or melted fuel, which has fantastically larger concentrations of radioactivity in it than that water.
And that's
the material
really,
that's going to be the most challenging of all.
And I believe that stays hot for years. Is that right?
Well, it varies. I mean, the radioactivity in this spent fuel, after 20 or so years, you're really stuck with a very large amount of long-lived radioactivity.
But, I mean, just in terms of being able to get to it and contain it, it's incredibly hot temperature-wise, isn't it, for a long time?
Well, it's thermally hot, and it's also, it's intensely radioactive.
Sure.
So, it didn't surprise me, and it saddened me to hear that workers are now having to face essentially life-threatening radiation doses in order to try to stabilize this problem. I mean, these are people who are doing very heroic things.
Well, of course, they were equally heroic in Chernobyl as well. So just in closing, Robert Alvarez, given your long experience in nuclear power and weapons, having been a senior policy advisor to the Secretary of Energy and the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy, how would you see this debate? Because the President just yesterday addressed the issue of energy independence. It seems like the environmental movement, to some extent, drank the Kool-Aid of nuclear power because they thought it was a solution to global warming. Do you think there's going to be some fresh thinking here?
I think there's no doubt about that. I think that there's, despite the rhetoric and supportive words about nuclear power from some of our political leaders, make no mistake, there is a very serious reassessment going on inside of the government. Especially about the safety of the operation of our existing reactors. The other situation is, in terms of new reactors, I think that, as I said, those prospects are very, very dim because, one, these reactors, their estimated costs are very high, somewhere on the order of $10 billion. And two, private investment will not have anything to do with them. So the taxpayer has to bear the financial burden in terms of extending the loan and taking the risk if the loan fails. So those are really not the best ingredients for a nuclear renaissance, to put it mildly. And I think that the role of nuclear power in coming to terms with things like global warming and our dependence on foreign sources of oil and those problems, the environmental problems associated and safety and health problems associated with consuming and producing energy. Nuclear power, I think, is so expensive, setting aside its catastrophic potential, which has been unfolding in Japan. A colleague of mine likened it to trying to come to terms with world hunger by serving caviar.
Well, I thank you for joining us on the, thank you for that note of irony there, Robert Alvarez, and I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Alvarez, who was Senior Policy Advisor to the Secretary of Energy and Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy. His recent writing, and particularly the op-ed he wrote for the Los Angeles Times called Unsafe at Any Reactor, is available at ips-dc.org. Let's take a brief station break and then we'll go to Cairo to talk about the Libyan revolution. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And let's now get another analysis on the situation in Libya. Joining me from Cairo is Mohamed Bamier. Mohamed Bamier is professor of sociology at the University of Pittsburgh. His books include The End of Globalization, Drugs in Motion, Mind and Body Altering Substances in the World's Cultural Economy, and Anarchy as Order, The History and Future of Civic Humanity. He has a forthcoming book called Intellectuals and Civil Society in the Middle East. The Islamic intellectual site Mufta.org recently published his essay, Is the 2011 Libyan Revolution an Exception? In your article, Mohamed Bamier, you do suggest that the ending may be somewhat similar to the Romanian president, Nicolae Ceausescu. So do you expect Gaddafi to be put up against a wall and shot, or will he flee to Chad and live out his exile in some sub-Saharan country?
If he's caught, I'm sure he will be at the very least, put to trial. That is what the National Council is saying. They want to put him on trial. But who knows? I think it is likely that he will try to escape to the south, at least, or to somewhere else. In Chad, indeed, that's one of the possibilities, and try to orchestrate some kind of trouble. I'm not sure exactly how or what are the real basis for doing that. But he's not the kind of person who is going to surrender. He knows that it is over for him. Yeah, and also, it is too late for him to be admitted into any country. There were, in the last few weeks, there were some offers that he could go, for example, to certain countries. Venezuela was mentioned, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates. But it's unlikely that any of those countries would want him now. So his options are becoming more and more limited, and that is why I expect that his end is going to be gloomy.
Again, I'm speaking with Mohamed Bamier, who's in Cairo, and you mentioned a second ago that you didn't think that the opposition forces, the so-called rebels, they want to put Gaddafi on trial, not execute him. And you make a distinction here, saying that they already are showing signs of a new civic ethic. Whereas Gaddafi's forces slaughter captured opposition members, the revolutionary camp holds its captives as prisoners of war. So there's already evidence of an ethic amongst these the opposition, but here in the Western press, they still appear to be a mystery, who they are and what their composition is.
Yes, I mean, the mystery is because all the revolutions are now a mystery. And that there's a reason for that, because they are not being organized by any established political party or any discernible organization. And they don't have any recognizable leadership, even though in Libya now you do have some kind of leadership, but it is very fluid. And the reason for that is that these are truly popular revolutions, in the sense that they have a spontaneous character. They first erupt and then organization and leadership come later after the revolution is in motion. And this is really a rare phenomenon in history. But that is really the pattern that we see all over the region right now. And the rebels are everyone. They are members of all classes of Libyan society. They are lawyers, they are workers, they are members of tribes. they don't really have any single political ideology. So in other words, they're not socialist or Islamist or what have you, but the demands are similar in a general sense to the demands that were raised in Libya, in Egypt, in Tunisia, and now in Yemen, and in Bahrain as well, in Syria as well, which is the establishment of democratic governing structures, the building of modern civic states, more civic liberties, and so on. So by and large, all these revolutions can be called liberal revolutions, in the sense. And the reason for that is sociological, I think, at the root of it, namely that in the past two or three decades, Arab societies in general have become far more modern than their governments, whereas the governments are continuing to run as basically as closed societies, basically with unquestioned leadership style and a dictatorial style as well. Society below them is becoming more and more modern, where youth cultures are vibrant, are strong, where society is connected to all kinds of modern communication technology, where education rates are also higher among men as well as among women, and so on. So that is the reality that is happening. All these forces, all these modernizing forces in the society are rising now and demanding a new type of state. And you see that in Libya as well. So it is, in a nutshell, if you want to call it, it is the civic culture of the country. That is the revolution. That is what it is. It's not a political party in particular. It is not any coherent organization. It is the sum total of all civic participatory traditions that are making the revolution. And that is what it is.
And of course, somewhat predictably, we're focused on evidence of Al-Qaeda, which of course is what Gaddafi has been trying to say all along. And even the one of the top NATO military leaders the other day said, well, there are flickers of Al-Qaeda amongst the opposition. But I think it's obviously been always exaggerated. But you're arguing that the tribalism has been overemphasized and that Gaddafi's state is not a tribal state so much as a mafia state.
Sure, exactly. I did look at that very carefully, and I have been looking at tribal declarations and declarations issued in the names of tribes. And also how tribes basically are addressed by the provisional government vis-a-vis how tribal discourse is used by the Gaddafi government. And tribes are not homogeneous entities. In other words, they don't really have executive councils. They don't move together. They live throughout Libya in particular. And most of Libyan society is urban, lives in major cities. About 88% of Libyan society lives, in fact, in urban areas. And the large urban areas include within them almost all members of all tribes in Libya that are intermarried. So it is a very mixed type of society, even though there are tribal loyalties, but they're not only loyalties that you have, and they're not unconditional. So it is not uncommon that you would see pro-Qaddafi and anti-Qaddafi elements within the same tribe. That is not uncommon. That happens, in fact. But it is not tribal. It cannot be described as a tribal society, even though, of course, a tribe, just as in Yemen, is part of the culture. But it is not the only kind of thing that people have loyalty to, and it is not an unconditional type of loyalty.
This fluid mix of tribal networks, Sufi orders, and coastal communities that you speak of does appear to be what we see on television, and what particularly strikes me as quite extraordinary. You know, we've talked about, particularly on the left, we've talked about people's revolution, people power, the Sandinistas, etc. But these people who are taking up arms and literally wearing jeans and T-shirts as if they've just left their homes and gone to the front, carrying a rusty old rifle. If anything exemplifies a people's army, they do.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, they do. These are old local traditions of modernized, of course, but this is like the people who are used to self-governance. Now they have a sense of collective national dignity that allows them a moral outrage. The excesses of the regime, its willingness to threaten its people with genocide, which it was doing, in fact. And there is a great deal of confidence that you see among those people. That's also, I saw that in Cairo as well as in Tunisia, in the sense that all these revolutions that we see around, and here in Libya is less of an exception, the participants, those people's armies, if you will, as well as people on the street in general, who are part of these revolutions, seem to exude an incredible level of confidence that I haven't actually seen before. That they are right, that the cause is right and just. There's a willingness to sacrifice and a martyr, and be a martyr, without that much use of religious discourse. So it is just moral outrage in a modern way against the excesses and inappropriateness of the style of government that they have. That is expressed in an almost secular kind of grievance. And that is what we seem to be witnessing here. Now, the regimes themselves don't know how to respond so far to all these revolutions, and on all of them, they really respond in the same way, which is to try to point to a threat that doesn't exist. The Qaeda is here, for example, or if we leave, fundamentalist forces are going to take over, and so on. So part of the government in charge arguing or wording in the face of these revolutions is to exaggerate the danger of chaos, the danger of extremism, the danger of fundamentalism if they were to be overthrown, and thereby seek to reduce whatever support that exists outside their countries for the revolutions. That is really the standard response, and it is not credible. Because Al-Qaeda is not there. Al-Qaeda doesn't know what to do with what is happening now. Even Islam itself is not being used as the language of resistance throughout any of these revolutions. None of these revolutions are about Islam. None of them are about reintroducing the Sharia, but they are about introducing a new modern democratic civic state throughout this region.
Well, again, I'm speaking with sociologist Mohamed Bamyeh, who is in Cairo. So there is, of course, criticism of NATO's intervention throughout the Middle East, starting with Turkey. I imagine there's some of it there in Egypt. But why is it that the president, in his speech last night, did say that it is a national security issue to defend the Libyan rebels, if you will, from being exterminated? That in turn would have created a refugee problem in both Egypt and Tunisia and affected these fragile new governments in transition. Why is it, though, that the Egyptian military, who are in control of Egypt at the moment, why aren't they helping out their brothers in next door in Libya?
The Egyptian army, the Egyptian state, now supported the no-fly zone and called on the UN to pass a resolution to that effect, and is supporting at least politically what the United States, France, and Britain are doing, and Qatar right now, of course, are doing in Libya. But the Egypt just emerged out of the revolution itself. The Egyptian army is too distracted. It is still in the streets of Cairo and the main cities. It is not on the front line. It is bogged down with the business of running the country. There is still a question of transition into writing a new constitution, electing a new parliament. That would happen probably 6 months from now, a new president eventually. All kinds of many revolutions that are happening in Egypt still, the aftermath of the revolution, such as strikes, demands for the removal of corrupt officials left over from the old regime here. All that is still happening in Egypt. So Egypt is there's too much distraction happening right now and too much need for the army to focus all its energies on running Egypt itself. So that is, and also the rebels, the thing that the rebels would need, I think, more than anything else now, because I think that this war will have to be managed ultimately by Libyans themselves, not by the outside world, but they need to be armed better. They need to be also supported politically more, in the sense that this provisional government needs to be acknowledged as the legitimate voice of the Libyan people. Part of the strategy, the American position that I don't understand is if you say that you can't live with Gaddafi anymore and that he is illegitimate, why not simply go one step further and recognize the opposition government as a legitimate government and work with it, and also have your allies do the same thing, just like as France did. So I think there are many, even though Egypt itself is unable right now to be involved directly, but it has been supporting in a humanitarian way. The borders are open with Libya. All kinds of supplies, medicines, food, and so on come through the border. So that helps. Yeah.
Just in closing, Mohamed Bamier, just to touch on what's happening in Egypt, where you are, it seems to me that there have been reports that the Muslim Brotherhood, who played a sort of backseat role in the nonviolent revolution that was largely propelled by young, urban, educated Egyptians, there are reports that they are making a comeback and that they've always sort of been the power behind the scenes and that they've made some kind of deal with the army, and that in future power shuffles, they will end up the kingmakers along with the army. Is that the possible outcome?
No, I think the Muslim Brotherhood is a significant political force in the country, and it will remain so. And in a democratic society, as the attempt now is being made in Egypt, if all significant political forces are represented, then of course they are going to be represented and they are going to have a role. But I don't think there has been any deal that was made so far. They did support the referendum that happened last about a week and a half ago to pass amendments to the Constitution so that we can move to the next stage of the transition. Other, of course, parts of the revolution opposed it. But they themselves are splintering like one would expect, because one thing that may happen, I think, is that the Muslim Brotherhood themselves may generate probably three different political parties. One has already been formed, sort of a left Islamic party that came out of the Brotherhood. The organization wants to form its own official kind of political party, which is a centrist Islamic party. There's another wing of it that wants to form a third Islamic party that comes out of the Brotherhood, and so on. So itself, the Brotherhood itself may become several parties at the end of this game, because it is itself a diverse group of individuals that was kept together because in the past they were repressed together, and therefore there was a lot of incentive to stick together. Also, under the dictatorship of Mubarak, when there were no options available, when there was no foreseeable transition into any kind of other form of governance, political Islam did not develop ideologically. There were no really new developments on the horizon in terms of Islamic political thinking, because nothing depended on it. There was no government and no state that were open to an Islamic takeover, certainly not in Egypt. Now that has changed, because when you run an active political Islamic party and you run for elections, you actually do have to present a viable platform that is persuasive. You have to receive criticism in the public sphere. You have to defend your position. You have to say something more than Islam is the solution. You have to be specific about how you're going to solve people's problems. So what is going to happen, and that is, I think, is more the more interesting question than whether the Muslim Brotherhood will take over or not, is what is going to happen to their thought, how it is going to develop further beyond that point. And it is developing, it is becoming a little bit more complex. The Turkish model is often being cited as the way to go, because in Turkey now you do have a successful example of sort of a conservative, traditional counter-Islamic party coming to power, and in fact, not imposing the Sharia, but rather running a modern, non-corrupt state, the Hali, and very successfully. So well, that is the model that has been talked about here as one of the pathways that political Islam in this country may take.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Cairo, Mohamed Bamier.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mohamed Bamier, who is a professor of sociology at the University of Pittsburgh. His books include Drugs in Motion, Mind and Body Altering Substances in the World's Cultural Economy, Anarchy as Order, the History and Future of Civic Humanity, and his forthcoming book, Intellectuals and Civil Society in the Middle East. Let's now take a brief station break, and we're back talking with Chris Hedges.
Hold the phone, the kid's gone corporate. 3 months in, you say you need a vacation. Listen, son, you're in the wrong vocation. This world's seductive, it can't be corruptive. It's 3 a.m. and I'm still productive. Lord over the city, from my tower, stretch out my arms and feel the power. I'm a Wall Street trader, Main Street player. Main Street boys call me.
Welcome back, I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. I'm now joined by Chris Hedges, who is a journalist, author, and social critic. In 2002, he's part of a team at the New York Times that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism, and he also received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights. His books include War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, What Every Person Should Know About War, American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, and Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. He is a regular columnist at truthdig.com, where he recently published an article called The Collapse of Globalization. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Hedges.
Thank you.
Just a couple of days ago, I spoke with the country's leading expert on taxes, David K. Johnston, and talking about taxes is very useful insight into a society's economic and social justice. And we talked about both the two big hoaxes, the deficit hoax, where at a time of a recession when you're supposed to stimulate the economy, the deficit hawks have won the day in terms of the argument that we now have to tighten our belts, or everybody but the rich have to tighten their belts. But the other big hoax is the globalism hoax. But you say it's over.
It is over. What we're watching now is the breakdown of globalization. We are clinging to dead ideas that have been utterly discredited. You know, for years, all we heard was that there could be no debt relief to the third world because debt payments were sacrosanct. And after about 2 weeks in 2006, with the collapse of the global economy, the very forces that had opposed any kind of debt relief bailed themselves out now to the tune of trillions of dollars after evaporating $40 trillion worth of wages, income, savings, mostly, of course, from small shareholders. We're watching a very steep rise and very frightening rise in commodity prices, especially in staples such as wheat that in the last 8 months has doubled in price. When you are attempting to feed yourself on about $2 a day, as over half the population of the globe is, these kinds of food increases mean malnutrition and even starvation. And I think we have to look closely at what's happening in countries like Yemen. Huge water shortages, by the way, in Yemen, Egypt, Tunisia, Ivory Coast, and realize that what we're seeing is the unraveling of this system, and we have to begin to speak in a new language and come up with new ideas. But unfortunately, the corporate forces that control the debate and that have seized dominance over our monetary system, our food, energy, education, press, healthcare, governance, have determined that we will sort of barrel forwards towards collapse. And of course, in the short term, it's quite beneficial to them. In the long term, it's catastrophic to everyone.
So the question is, Chris Hedges, why did we believe this in the first place, this race to the bottom globalization hoax, which has only benefited the financial elite on Wall Street and Chinese peasants?
Well, it was quite consciously promoted by corporations. They took fringe figures like Milton Friedman and Friedrich von Hayek, who are probably two of the most important architects for unregulated capitalism, economists that certainly when they began were not considered serious thinkers by most people, and through the wonders of corporate propaganda and corporate funding, the theories of these fringe figures became embraced by think tanks, the press, corporate boardrooms, universities, legislative bodies, courts, and we still hear this cant, a about getting government off our backs, even though, of course, their economic theories have been utterly discredited. The problem is that anybody who talks in another paradigm, anybody who challenges the assumptions and structures of globalism, are shut out. And one thinks of Noam Chomsky or Ralph Nader as a long list. You know, John Ralston Saul, a writer I admire very much, has sort of laid it out that every single one of globalism's promises have turned out to be a lie. The economic inequity around the globe has gotten worse. The world's wealth has become concentrated into the hands of a tiny elite. The middle class, which is, of course, the heart of any capitalist democracy, is disappearing. The rights and wages of the working class have fallen into precipitous decline as we have destroyed labor regulations, our manufacturing base, and, of course, labor unions themselves. And we have watched as, in the name of free trade and a worldwide economy, as Thomas Friedman said, you know, this sort of jingoistic, the world is flat kind of mentality. Corporations have used the destruction of trade barriers as a mechanism for massive tax evasion, and that technique allows huge corporations, conglomerates like General Electric, not to pay any taxes at all. Or Halliburton, which is a completely parasitic corporation. It makes all of its money, or almost all its money, from taxpayers, and yet it sets up all its subsidiaries in Dubai, so it doesn't have to pay taxes.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Chris Hedges, whose article, The Collapse of Globalism, is out on truthdig.com. You mentioned in your article the proponents of globalism, Thomas Friedman, Daniel Yergin, Ben Bernanke, and Anthony Giddens. I have to add here that Daniel Yergin's monitor group has now been exposed for having taken money from Gaddafi. But the other person who I think has to be high up on that list is one of the great hoaxes of all time, and that is Alan Greenspan, who you point out believed in a third-rate novelist. He didn't only believe in her, he was the executor of her estate, Ayn Rand. He believed that Ayn Rand was an economic prophet. How did that guy become our economic prophet?
Because corporations wanted him to be our economic prophet. When you look at the intellectual absurdities that these people embraced, it's frightening. And then, of course, you get that mea culpa from Greenspan, where he concedes that not only did he have no idea that this was coming, but that he admits that he was naive, that somehow the market could regulate itself. What's amazing is that after all of these ideas have been discredited, they're still being peddled within the mainstream because, of course, corporations control most of our systems of information. And anybody who is going to point out that all of globalism's promises are, you know, utopian and absurd, it doesn't get a voice, even now. And that's what's truly frightening, because we are watching essentially the cannibalization of the state, and in particular the U.S. Treasury, to service a dead system, to reinflate an economic bubble, and not to confront the criminal behavior on behalf of the financial elite. It's just, it is really staggering. The size of the theft and fraud is staggering. And the utter inability on the part of systems of governance to curb that fraud, and not only curb it, but of course what they've actually done is re-empower it.
Again, I'm speaking with Chris Hedges, who wrote a new article at truthdig.com, The Collapse of Globalization. In this article, you'd say dying civilizations often prefer hope, even absurd hope, to the truth. And that would seem to me that what is happening here in our media, in our corporate media, in terms of entertainment, is particularly subversive. I'll just quote from your article. The perversion of values has created a landscape where corporate management by sleazy figures like Donald Trump is confused with leadership, and where the ability to accumulate vast sums of money is confused with intelligence. And when we do glimpse the poor or working class on our screens, they're ridiculed and taunted. They are objects of contempt, whether on the Jerry Springer Show or Jersey Shore. But I would add to that, Chris Hedges, that we have these new shows, reality shows now, the Undercover Boss and Secret Millionaire, that seemed entirely designed to encourage this lottery mentality amongst American in the working class, that, and also to make the bosses human beings, just like you. They're just regular folk, regardless of the fact that they're making them 1,000 times more money than the poor working stiff who is being conned into believing that somehow one day he can win the lottery.
Yes, and that, you know, we are a culture utterly awash in lies. These public relations, the public relations industry is very effective and has been for many decades at manipulating emotion, making us confuse how we are made to feel with knowledge. And they have done a tremendous job of discrediting working men and women. Look what's happening to teachers and public sector unions at the moment, and trumpeting these sort of gruesome figures like Donald Trump. You know, and as you read from the story, confusing this capacity for manipulation to make money with qualities of leadership or with intelligence, and the sort of belittling of our poor culturally is part and parcel of precisely creating this paradigm where the elite is lionized and venerated, and our disenfranchised working class become, at least through the systems of propaganda, the butt of jokes, of ridicule.
But do you think there's any way, though, that we can prick this bubble of a capitalist delusion that we have here in American capitalism, which is all about the elite extracting wealth, not creating wealth? And this whole Horatio Alger meritocracy myth is completely fictional, because if, as you point out in the article, what's been happening now is that speculators are gaming the price of food and the price of oil. Now, I had the former head of the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission on the other day, who laid out an extremely cogent and evidence-laden case that the price of oil has nothing to do with Libya and all these other things. It's entirely to do with Wall Street people betting that oil will go up, and in making that, placing $40 billion on a bet, sure enough, it does go up, and they make money, and every person in this country who shows up at the pump to fill up their gas tank is being gouged, and somehow they just take it.
Well, they take it for a while. I mean, it's not a sustainable system. It's one that's tearing itself apart. And as that gap opens up, you know, when the day comes, and we're already seeing it in some states, like Michigan, that unemployment benefits are not extended. There was a front page story in the New York Times on the whole program that the Obama administration had set up to help unemployed people pay their mortgages. They haven't paid a dime because the banks don't want them to pay a dime. There is no stopping at this point. The rapaciousness of the corporate state, we've undergone a coup d'etat in slow motion, and it's over. We've lost. They've won. And they know no limits. So people will wake up. But by the time they wake up, they will have been deeply impoverished. Certainly the bottom two-thirds that are now constitute America's underclass, and we will see Homeland Security in forms of draconian control. Take a look at what they're doing to Bradley Manning, used more nakedly on the part of the corporate behemoth in order to reconfigure American society into this terrifying form of neo-feudalism.
Well, of course, the ultimate irony is that the people who have done more to change the political and economic and social landscape to our detriment have been the Supreme Court, and particularly the Citizens United decision, which is probably the most radical decision ever in hundreds of years of the Supreme Court, allowing corporations unlimited money to buy a political system that they already owned, but to buy it lock, stock, and barrel now. These same originalists, of course, obviously haven't read the Declaration of Independence, because after the main preamble about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it goes on to say that if a government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to overturn it and replace it with a government more to their liking or choosing. I'm paraphrasing here, but the long and the short of it is...
Remember Mother Jones got arrested for reading that.
Right, but
passage to coal miners in West Virginia.
Yeah, but I'm bringing it up, Chris Hedges, because I think that the genius of America is that the revolutionary mechanism is built into the Constitution. And if the people finally wake up, they can change this toxic and predatory government and live out the American dream.
Well, I think the problem is that the corporate state has now cemented into place mechanisms of control in terms of the surveillance and security state that are utterly terrifying. And that will make it, and you go back and look at the Church hearings in 1975 when Church was appalled at the technological capacity that the intelligence community had handed to the state, will make it very, very difficult for dissent. These people, you know, are going to go down not like Mubarak, but like Gaddafi.
So just in closing then, Chris Hedges, I hesitate to relegate our fate to utter hopelessness. What is your sense of how this can be reversed?
Well, I think with the collapse of globalization, which is what's happening, and of course, we haven't even brought up the whole issue of climate change, people are going to have to begin to take care of themselves, which means creating sustainable communities, because as food prices skyrocket, as fuel prices skyrocket, as this permanent underclass begins to suffer, as state and federal programs are cut, we are already watching, of course, inflation through and rising commodity prices, which makes food more difficult. About 40 million Americans now spend about 35% of their income on food. That's only going to go up. We're going to have to take care of ourselves. So sustainable agriculture becomes huge because the elite, as they already are doing, are retreating into gated communities. And Naomi Klein has written about this, where they wall themselves off from the misery that is inflicted on the masses. And I think that we have to recognize that the state is not going to take care of us. These corporate forces are not going to protect us. We're going to have to do it ourselves, and I think that becomes a form of resistance. I'm all for rebellion, and I'm all for resistance and defying the corporate state. Yet at the same time, I think we have to be very realistic about the power that the state has accrued to itself, especially in terms of internal security. It's as anyone who's gone to the G20 protests, as I have, can tell you.
Well, Chris Hedges, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Hedges, who is the author of What Every Person Should Know About War, American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War on America, and Empire of Illusion, the End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. You can find his article, The Collapse of Globalization, at truthdig.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You may hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I've also started a daily blog there. Go to ianmasters.com and click on blog and let me know what you think. Bye for now.